from Portland, Oregon, this is the Jewish Review Podcast. I'm Brock Niebel. Coming up this episode, after 16 long months of war for Israel and 16 months of captivity for hostages being held by Hamas, a ceasefire agreement is now in place between the parties and hostages have started coming home. Last week, just days after the first group of hostages had been returned, I spoke with Becky Caspi, the Senior Vice President for Global Operations and Director General of the Israel Office for the Jewish Federations of North America. We talked about the status of the ceasefire agreements both in Gaza and on Israel's northern border, the road to recovery for those still being affected by war, and how JFNA's work in Israel in pre-October 7th times made their support of Israeli society today possible. Stay with us. The Jewish Review Podcast is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, presenting Gather Grants. Looking to build Jewish community in your corner of our area? The Federation's Gather Grants program can help you with ideas, resources, and financial support to help you do Judaism your way. Learn more in the January 22nd edition of the Jewish Review or at jewishportland.org/ourcommunity/gathergrants. Link in the episode notes. Now, here's Becky Caspi. Becky Caspi, welcome to the Jewish Review Podcast.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. So tell me about your Jewish journey.
Well, I was thinking about that a little while ago, and I think maybe my Jewish journey can best be described as a little bit of internal archaeology. It wasn't at all what one might predict, especially given what I do for a living. I did not grow up in a connected Jewish family. It was a Jewish family, but we didn't do synagogue, and we didn't do Jewish camp, and we didn't do Jewish school. We were proud citizens of the city in which I was raised, and on principle, we engaged in public activities and not Jewish activities. But I also was raised with a great deal of intellectual freedom, and that led me to the study of history, and the study of history led me to an understanding of the Jewish journey of our people. And I think I connected first to our people. And then over time, I realized that while I've just described to you having been raised in a family that didn't formally do Jewish, I definitely grew up in a family that revolved around and lifted up core Jewish values. And that made it possible, as I began to connect myself on my own journey more Jewishly, to find commonality and connection with people who had been raised in completely different environments. It just resonated for me. Family, community, really good sense of humor on the personal side, and professionally, things like service and responsibility and commitment. So I think in the end, it turns out that the life I want to lead is Jewish in its essence, but perhaps not necessarily typical in its expression.
All right. And that the expression of that has taken your physical journey to Israel, where you are now based, yeah?
Yes, indeed.
All right. So we've had a sort of a sea change in the news, so to speak. There's finally been a ceasefire arrangement in place. For those who maybe have not read the news so closely, what is the framework of this agreement that's now taken hold?
If only things were that simple. In fact, it turns out that we have to talk about two separate ceasefire agreements. We have a ceasefire in the north with Hezbollah, which is now governing the situation in Lebanon, the degree that can be governed. And we have a ceasefire with Hamas in the south. So what do you want to talk about first?
Let's talk about Gaza. Let's talk about the ceasefire with Hamas.
Okay. So the ceasefire with Gaza was reached after many, many, many long and painful months of negotiations, false hopes, expectations. But finally, and probably common wisdom is in advance of the inauguration of President Trump, the agreement was finally approved. It was approved by Israel's cabinet, by the government. It did not require approval by the Knesset, by Israel's parliament. And it came into force on Sunday morning, just a few days ago on January 19th. Some of the key aspects of the ceasefire: the one I think that most people have focused on from the Israeli side of the border is it dictates over the course of 42 to 50 days, the release of 33 hostages.
Out of 100 that are still being held by Hamas in Gaza?
there were a total of 98 when the ceasefire was signed. And now the first three young women have come home. And that was a day of tremendous euphoria. I have to say anecdotally, and maybe some of our listeners will enjoy knowing this, that a number of people reported to me they couldn't believe how light the traffic was from all different parts of the country, because everybody was glued to the television screens waiting to see, was it going to become real? And there were some stops and starts even that very day. And when the ceasefire did not come into force at the time it was anticipated, because the names of the people to be released were not provided to Israel on time, I guess what I want to share first and foremost with our listeners is that it is in force, but it is tenuous, and it is, I don't think that Israel will collectively and Israelis fully breathe out until we see the first of our 33 hostages returned home. As I said, over 42 to 50 days. Mm-hmm. And in this part of the world, an awful lot can happen in that period of time. I'll share too that as hostages start to be released, Israel, in return, is beginning to release Palestinian security prisoners. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about the mood of the country at this moment, is everybody out dancing in the streets? Many people, I won't say anyone was dancing in the streets, but many people wept for joy and felt a great lightening and a lift of spirits as we saw the first images of our hostages being freed. But there are many families who may be very far on the other side of that equation. They know that the people that injured or killed their precious family members are now being released. And that is causing for many of them great pain and sadness and confusion and concern. And there are many in Israel, because we know from prior prisoner release agreements that a very, very high percentage of security prisoners who've been released in the past have returned to terrorist activities after they were freed. And so there's a concern that releasing a very large number of people, including murderers and even mass murderers, is something we're a little bit nervous about. Mm-hmm.
I've seen it cited in the media repeatedly that one such past prisoner exchange included none other than Yahya Sinwar, the now deceased former leader of Hamas.
Yes, indeed.
So I suppose that alludes to some of the political divides in Israel, that reaction to these events is mixed, both because they're complex events, certainly with upsides and trade-offs, and because there's a lot of different attitudes and feelings about the situation within Israeli society.
Absolutely. And in fact, there were two parties that are, or were, members of Israel's coalition government. And perhaps it's worth opening parentheses and saying both Israel and the United States are democracies, but we're different kinds of democracies. So Israel is what's called a parliamentary democracy, which means that you don't vote for a head of government. You vote for a party list. And then the party that receives the highest number of votes in any given national election is generally offered the first opportunity to try and patch together a coalitional government. In order to succeed in doing that, they have to achieve the bare minimum of a majority, 61 out of 120 members of Knesset. So that is often a very delicate balance. And as a result of this hostage deal and ceasefire agreement being approved by the government, the Jewish Strength Party, headed by former Minister Ben-Gvir, actually resigned from the government. And another party, the Religious Zionism Party, also objected to the agreement, but Bezalel Smotrich, the head of that party, opted not to resign at this point. Mm-hmm. So even within the prime minister's own majority government, it wasn't a simple political equation to get to yes on this deal. No.
And those who have followed Israeli politics, casually will know that there's really nothing simple when it comes to this current Israeli government.
Well, that's for sure true. Although it's worth noting, and I draw some hope from this, that the head of the opposition, Yair Lapid, mm-hmm. has said to the prime minister that as long as he is moving to approve deals that will see hostages returned home, he, as the head of opposition, will back those deals. And that doesn't happen every day.
No. You mentioned deals plural. I think we should go back and point out that the ceasefire arrangement in Gaza is a multi-stage arrangement. We discussed the first stage wherein Israel gets back 33 of its hostages from Gaza in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. What are stages 2 and 3 from there?
So first I'll just add to stage 1 that while we're very, very focused on the immediate and direct human impact of people moving in both directions, there are other aspects of the deal that also relate to partial withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza and more limited control over certain very key strategic pieces of territory, particularly the Philadelphia corridor, which has been the pathway and the byway through which really the vast majority of the munitions and people movement into Gaza that has turned out to have been such a deadly threat to Israel took place. So that's also at play. On stage 2, which effectively will begin to be wrapped up on the 16th day of phase 1, I think that means essentially that enough time will have gone by that both sides will see that it appears to be a good faith deal and the first parts of the agreement are cycling into play. On day 16, negotiations will begin for the release of the remaining 65 hostages outside of the first phase of the agreement. Sadly, it's generally believed that a large number of the 65 additional hostages are likely no longer alive. And it is Israel's intent to work towards the release of all living hostages first. Mm-hmm. But it's also worth noting that we do not yet know the status of all of the first 33 who are slated to come home. But in the second stage, in addition, again, to negotiating for more people movement in both directions, we will see the discussions focus on ongoing security arrangements, more areas from which Israel will evacuate, a discussion around who will be in control of Gaza once Israel has left, and who is going to govern this territory and be a reliable authority which will enable Israel to continue to respect the security arrangements that it is negotiating for.
Mm-hmm. And this would lead to, the goal for these negotiations ostensibly is to lead to a resumption of the arrangement that was in place before October 7th, in which there are not Israeli troops or Jewish civilians in the Gaza Strip?
Well, hopefully, at least from the Jewish civilian side, it will be improved because we also have an Ethiopian Israeli who actually crossed into Gaza on his own 10 years ago, as well as a Bedouin Israeli, both of them having some significant mental health challenges. They walked into Gaza and they have been held there against their will for a very, very long time. So we hope that the tally on that front is going to actually improve. Yes, I believe you're correct that there would be no IDF or other military forces in Gaza after what we hope will be, I'm a bit reluctant to describe as a final ceasefire agreement, having lived in this part of the world for a very long time. But I will also say for us as Israelis and for the people of Gaza, perhaps there could even be a significant leap forward. There are certainly discussions around one or more of the Gulf state countries playing a significant role in the ceasefire agreement and overseeing of the reconstruction of Gaza and governing of Gaza after hostilities are ceased. And with President Trump, who I believe we all salute for his having brought forth the Abraham Accords, which resolved a very perpetual state of, if not active conflict, for sure, not peace between Israel and some of our neighbors and some of the other Muslim countries, it's a moment where perhaps we can dream or hope that something equally unexpectedly forward-focused might happen. I want to be very clear to you and to our listeners I'm not reporting on intel. I'm not a member of these discussions. But all of us here are very tuned into the fact that peace between Saudi Arabia and Israel was being discussed and negotiated before October 7th. And with the architect of the Abraham Accords now in the White House, perhaps that could be something we could look forward to.
So there is something of a semblance of hope for an improvement in the situation, which has been a long time coming, of course.
Let's say, at the very least, that's where you find me today.
Well, I'm happy to find you there. Moving our focus, let's shift towards the northern border up near Lebanon. A ceasefire went into place there with Hezbollah a few weeks ago. How has the situation progressed up there?
So it went into effect on November 27th, and it was negotiated to be a 60-day ceasefire. So if you're doing rapid math, you will know that right on Sunday, Monday, that's the end of the 60-day period. So I would say we're actually speaking to one another at a moment of cautious optimism. Mm-hmm. The ceasefire has held well throughout this 60-day period, with only two rockets launched, I believe, throughout that time, and Israel continuing in a very measured way, as it said it would, to remove immediate threats. In other words, terrorist operatives who have been moving around in southern Lebanon against the conditions of the ceasefire deal. And I actually just returned from 3 days in the north. Way up on the border, I was in Matula and Margaliot and Kiryat Shmona and speaking with both political leaders and civil society leaders and just people who live there. And everybody's on pins and needles. Yeah. They would like to believe that this ceasefire will hold. And if it does, it will continue and all sides will honor their commitments going forward. I think there's some significant concern that Hezbollah may seek to return to the southern part of Lebanon, closer to the border with Israel, which would be in violation of the ceasefire agreement, and that we might see a resumption of hostility. I believe that the IDF is prepared for both eventualities, and everyone is hoping and praying that the ceasefire will hold.
Has the situation on the Lebanese border been influenced, to your knowledge at all, by recent events in Syria with the toppling of Bashar al-Assad's government?
I'm sure that it is more difficult than it used to be for Hezbollah to rearm and be resupplied because certain critical corridors and delivery paths are no longer available to them. And certainly what you're hinting at as well is one of the very big looming open questions is, what will the Iranian regime choose to do? Will they continue to, as they have in the past, to arm Hezbollah? Will they pivot and work with other potential partners and groups? Will they turn inward and deal with some of the ills and challenges within Iranian society itself? I don't know. And I think for all of us, this is a time of watching and waiting and preparing.
Pins and needles, like you said.
Yep.
So with the evolving, and it seems like positively evolving, situation on both the northern border and around the Gaza envelope, have folks in Israel been able to, is there any thought of sort of the of October 9th, so to speak? Because what we've been hearing for more than a year now is that it's still October 8th. It's still like Israeli mentality is still the day after the attacks. Has there been any sort of psychological shift towards the day after the day after?
Great question. And as I said earlier in our conversation, it's a pretty volatile neighborhood. So it often depends on what day, after which news story, at what hour you might catch up with any one of your Israeli friends or family. I think, though, I'll zoom back and try and answer that more broadly. First, it's important to understand that the situation in the communities in the Western Negev around the Gaza Strip that were so horrifically impacted on October 7th is in some ways farther along down their path to recovery, far farther along than Israelis who are in the north. And I'll explain why. While the whole region was evacuated after the Hamas attack, most of the residents of southern Israel and the western Negev have returned home. So there are a few of the hardest hit kibbutzim for whom that journey is going to take a longer period of time. So Kibbutz Be'eri, which was evacuated mostly as a community to the David Hotel at the Dead Sea for a long time, is now in temporary quarters at Kibbutz Chatzurim. They're there as a community in temporary housing. Their homes are going to take a couple more years until they are ready for them to be able to relocate back home. But they've stayed together as a community, and they are living in a kibbutz environment. And even they, among the hardest hit, are on the road to recovery. It's not simple. There are many lingering issues. The biggest gaping open wound, of course, as we spoke about earlier, the fate of our hostages. I don't think that Israel will be able to fully pivot towards recovery until every single Israeli is home. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we need to know. It's really almost indescribable, the pain on the one hand and the commitment of so many on the other to bring every last person home. So for most of the kids of the Western Negev, they started this school year back in their communities. They are spent much of the summer being prepared for that through programs that Jewish federations, which I represent, and others were helpful in providing to them to stabilize them. No simple thing to be living with your parents in a very small hotel room for month after month after month, and be separated from friends and have all of the different challenges and perhaps wounded family members, an older brother, an older sister who's in combat, from whom you don't hear that often and has been away for hundreds of days, or maybe that's your dad, or maybe that's your mom. The impact of this war is so deep and touches every member of Israeli society, many, many, in multiple ways. So I think, though, that for those in the South who were displaced for months, but a much shorter period of time, they are farther along on the road to recovery, as I said. Mm-hmm. For people in the far north along the Lebanese border, it's too early to return home. The government is speaking about March 1st, reopening the schools in that area. Many of the schools have actually been significantly damaged, so there are challenges with that. And then just south of the confrontation line and the places from which people were evacuated, you actually have hundreds of thousands of Israelis who have been living literally through war and under fire for many, many months. And even if they weren't displaced, their lives were completely disrupted. The basis of the northern economy draws primarily from agriculture and tourism, two things which were severely impacted by this war. So the road to recovery there, and the question of whether or not Hezbollah is going to be allowed, either by the Lebanese army, which is tasked with the responsibility for security across all of Lebanon, but from a very Israeli perspective, south of the Litani River, whether they will have the ability to keep Hezbollah out, and frankly, the degree to which the United States and others may require that of them or even engage in some manner is, I think, going to be the determining factor. What you hear from absolutely everyone is until security is restored and until people feel secure, perhaps two separate things, mm-hmm. perhaps the same, it will take time before many Israelis return to the far north of the country.
Yeah. And I imagine even for folks who are not living in evacuated areas or areas that have been under fire, moving forward, particularly getting back to some of the issues that were prominent in Israeli civil life before October 7th, talking about judicial reform, military service exemptions for yeshiva students, those are going to be, we'll be getting back to those maybe eventually, but not today and certainly not tomorrow, I imagine.
I really hate to disappoint you, but both of those are very hot button issues right now, today in Israel. And the question of what our judicial system will look like and how that will operate. Well, there's a new proposal on the table by the architect of the initial proposal, and how things are going to move forward. This is something that is once again seeing significant opposition massing around the current, and I will say in fairness, more modest proposal than what was originally advanced. And the question of the burden of service, as it's frequently referred to in Israel, particularly at a time when it is truly not uncommon to be chatting with someone, and usually it's him, for him to say to you, yes, I've done 418 days of reserve service. I've done 320, or maybe just 250. But those are multiples of days away from family, away from work, through which they have experienced things that are entirely disruptive. So to put that against or in comparison to a part of our society that is actively working to maintain the right not to be called to service is a very tricky thing to navigate at this moment.
Yeah. When it comes to tricky things to navigate, I'm sensing a theme when it comes to that in Israeli politics.
Well, one thing I even think is, I'm not sure this is medically accurate, but I don't think you ever need a coronary stress test in this country. I feel like if you've made it through the day or the week, you're probably going to be okay.
Well, of the many things I am not, a physician is one of them, so I have no basis with which to argue with you on that. It certainly seems to be borne out by what you've been telling me. So you mentioned some of the relief work that JFNA has been doing in the Negev Desert. Tell me both about the work across the country that Jewish Federations of North America have done in the wake of October 7th to support Israeli society, and the work that JFNA was already doing in the bygone pre-October 7th world of Israel.
Back in normal times, you mean? Whatever those might have been?
Yeah, whatever those might have been.
Right. Well, I'm going to start there, if I may, because I think it's really important to understand that it is largely by virtue of what federations have been doing for decades in Israel that we were so well positioned to respond to something none of us could ever have imagined, the events of October 7th. And that is decades-long investing in our partnerships with the Jewish Agency for Israel and the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. They have really now, for in one case, almost 100 years, and in the second case, for more than 100 years, been our primary partners for work outside of North America. And that allowed us, because they have significant infrastructure and trained staff and critical relationships and presence across this country, that allowed us, working in partnership with them, to do things like fill the coffers of an initiative known as the Fund for the Victims of Terror, which is administered by the Jewish Agency and has been for nearly 20 years, which within the first 72 hours of a terror incident is at the bedside, knocking on the door or giving a hug to the people. Any person who is in Israel and is impacted that way, whatever part of society or even tourists, to provide them a critically important hug from the global Jewish community and financial assistance to allow them. And just imagine, your house just got slammed by a rocket. Your prescription medication is there. Your pajamas are there. You don't even have your wallet. You can't take a cab to go to your sister-in-law's house. What do you do? And there you are. You have somebody on behalf of the global Jewish community through our partnership who says, here you go. Here's $1,000. Go solve your most critical problems. And that's literally what happens. And then over the coming 3 years, as your rehabilitation begins to happen, there are opportunities for us to continue to help those families and fill gaps in therapies and in other ways that are not filled by all of the other parts of government and civil society that also lift up and support terror victims. That's just one example. Our president and CEO, who I think may have been a guest on this very podcast not that long ago, Eric Fingerhut.
He was an excellent one as well.
Thank you. Well, he often says, you don't build a fire department when your house is on fire. You've got to build it long before, so you're there and ready to respond. And that's what those partnerships, along with working with a sacred organization called the Israel Trauma Coalition, which brings together dozens and dozens of organizations here in Israel that help people who are in pre-trauma, active trauma, and then far too many who end up dealing with PTSD, with post-traumatic stress disorder. That's another of our critical partners. And I know we don't have time for me to swell with pride and tell you about everybody that we work with in normal times, mm-hmm. in ways that positioned us to be so live and quick in our response to the events of October 7th. I'll pivot if that makes sense. It allowed us to turn our attention very, very quickly to a number of critical areas that we've ended up describing as lifeline services. And if you can imagine back to the chaos of the early days, weeks, and months of this awful war, that meant everything from getting food to people who didn't have it, helping them get clothing, paying for volunteers to be able to go out and help farmers harvest in the fields because all of the foreign workers who traditionally do that work in Israel understandably fled the country and went home, to setting up temporary schools and hotels and in other places where evacuees were living, grants for every hospital, grants to trauma organizations, to our ambulance services. Perhaps I'll mention two others under this lifeline services category, of which I find particularly moving and I'm so very proud. One was a series of grants that we did to provide spiritual guidance and pastoral care. There was an unimaginable number of funerals that were happening. Many, many, many families who were sitting Shiva in the Jewish community or grieving in other faith communities here in Israel, and they needed additional supports. And I'm so proud that that's something Jewish Federation stepped in to do. And another, you know, when you go deep and you start to realize in how many ways this war has affected Israelis, we were approached by two organizations that had never worked together before, IDF Widows and Orphans, and the Umbrella Group of Israel's Midwives, because there were so many women who were pregnant, whose partners had fallen, and who needed assistance through their pregnancy, during childbirth, and in the early days and weeks of being postpartum and dealing with the newborn. And when we were first approached, if I'm remembering correctly, they asked us to help with 33 expectant mothers. And they've come back time and time again for additional support. And that is some of the hardest and easiest money that we allocated. It was hard because every time they came back, our hearts broke just a little more. And it was easy because we were never going to leave those women alone at this critical, hard moment in normal times, whatever those are. And now in the midst of this war.
Yeah. Well, I can see why that's something you're proud to be a part of. And as a Federation staffer here in North America, I am very proud of our small part in that as well. So thank you so much for that work and for your time. Becky Caspi, thank you for joining us on the Jewish Review Podcast.
An honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for this episode of the Jewish Review Podcast. An enormous thank you to Becky Caspi of JFNA for her insight into the ongoing events in Israel, and to JFGP President and CEO Mark Blattner for helping bring this episode together. You can learn more about how JFNA is supporting Jewish life in Israel and right here at home online at jewishfederations.org. If you like this episode, please leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice to help others find our show. Click subscribe to get our latest episode every 2 weeks, and tell a friend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out by email to editor@jewishportland.org. Don't forget, you can get the latest news from Portland's vibrant Jewish community by subscribing to The Jewish Review online at jewishportland.org/Jewish Review. The Jewish Review podcast is a production of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Our associate editor is Karone Blau-Rothstein. Special thanks to Daniel Berger. Our theme music is by Isaac Joel. I'm Rockney Roll. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, all the best.